You're listening to the Teaching Podcast for Crossridge Women. The following is audio from our Fall 2025 study in the book of Job. The Bible's a book. You know, God could have done anything he wanted to reveal himself to us. He's God. He could have, like, painted this amazing sunset. And when we see the sunset, we know everything about God. Or he could have done sort of a download at a certain time in your life. You just sort of like drop all the knowledge about himself into your head, right? Or maybe he could have created some sort of music that is woven into the universe. And when you hear the music, that would teach you about God. God could have chosen any number of ways to reveal himself to us, but he chose to use words and human authors who would write those words down. God gave us a book. And actually, it's a book full of books, right? It's a book of 66 books. And we always start by saying, how many different authors wrote the Bible? About 40. 40 different people. And do you know they lived over what span of time? Yeah, about 2,000 years. Over 2,000 years, 40 different authors wrote, with many different human genres in three different languages, Hebrew, Greek, Aramaic. And yet what we have, miraculously, by the power of the Holy Spirit and God's sovereignty, we have one story that all those books work together. And even the books of Obadiah and Ezekiel, they all are a really important part of this one beautiful story about God and what he wants to do to pursue humanity and to be in relationship with humanity, okay? So the Bible is a book, and because it's a book, that means it's written by human authors who write in different ways. And we call that genre. Okay, the Bible is written in lots of different genres. We have lots of different genres of books on our bookshelf, probably at home. You got textbooks, you got cookbooks, maybe you have an encyclopedia. Anybody still have an encyclopedia on their shelf, right? You have like novels, and then maybe you have some sort of like nonfiction, I don't know, a parenting book or something. Or if you do, send it to me because I have teenagers. But these human authors wrote in human styles of writing, which turn out to be a lot of different genres. In the back of your book, once again, I think it's page 63. It just talks about biblical genres. Those are all the different kinds of genres. I know that I was an English major at one time in my life, and some of you come to study and then you're like, come on, I don't want to go to English class. But I do always want to say, but God chose words. God chose to give you words so that you can know who he is. And you know what? Every people group has language. Every people group in the world uses story to tell about meaningful parts of life. So we can do it. Let's think about Job for a second. First of all, how many people have actually read the book of Job before or studied it or know a little bit about what it is even, maybe? Maybe you've never read it, but you know a little bit. Yeah. When you look at that list of Bible genres, what would you say? Wisdom literature. So I'm going to give you a definition here. A group of books that focus on questions of life, morality, meaning, human behavior, and the nature of God. They're often poetic or sort of philosophical. You know, they're like greatly reflective as you think about what is the meaning of life and what is wisdom. And they always explore these deep issues of the meaning of life, grounded in this idea that God is a God of order and that he is sovereign over all things. So some of the other wisdom books in the Bible are Ecclesiastes or Proverbs, right? In the New Testament, actually, there is a wisdom book too, the book of James. So lots of practical information about what wisdom is and how to live wise in this life. So the book of Job is wisdom literature. And then in all those genres, there are three text types. And no matter what genre you're reading, you can look in it and you can identify different types of writing. And those are poetry, prose, and discourse. And you can say that a lot more simply. There are songs, there are stories, and there are speeches. So from what you know, what types of texts do you think we're going to find as we start studying through the Book of Job? All of them. Ding, ding, ding. Yes, all of them. A huge part of it, 90%, is poetry. And interestingly, those poems are also speeches, right? It is dialogue going back and forth. This person gives a speech in poetic form, and then someone answers them in poetic form. And then someone gives another speech, and then someone responds to that. 90% is poetry, basically from chapter 3 all the way to 42, verse 6, except for 5 verses at the beginning of 32. It's all poetry. And the rest of that, the first two chapters, chapters 1 and 2, and then from 42, 7 to 17, are narrative. It's a story, right? It tells sort of the story of who Job is and what his circumstances are. We are going to now, with our table groups, we're going to get into this narrative. So if you are studying a story in the Bible, and you want to see what the text actually says, because you know what? If you have heard a sermon about Job before, or you heard someone talk about the book of Job, maybe you read it a long time ago, maybe you even studied it a long time ago, maybe you read about it in a children's Bible to one of your kids or to a grandchild or something. If you had experience with Job before, you probably would bring that sort of thinking, like a framework. Well, I heard this before, so I kind of already know in my mind what's going to happen or what this means. I heard this pastor say this good thing about it. And what we always want to do is we want to look at the text. We want to see it for ourselves. And actually, we want to be surprised by it. We want to see things in it that maybe we didn't know were there because we never really looked closely at it. Or maybe we were just reading it from the Action Bible, right? And it was a cartoon or something like that. So we are going to do that together. We are going to dig into chapters 1 to chapter 2:10. So at your tape group, your leader now is going to lead you through a time of studying together. When we come to a narrative story, if you need to know what's the story about, what kind of things are you looking for? What are you paying attention to? Characters. What else? The plot, the setting. Yeah. Anything else?
Dialogue.
Themes, dialogue, mini conflict, something that starts the plot going. Yeah. We are going to look at characters and setting and actually even repetition, because in every single text type, the first really important thing that we can look at in the Bible is things that the author says more than once. Because if the author says it more than once, the author really wants us to pay attention to it. So I'm going to hand it over to your table leaders now, and you are going to work through questions number 3 to 7. Off to group leaders. Thank you. Okay, we started at the beginning saying that when we look at any book of the Bible, when we're going to study it, when we're going to read it, we always want to think about this thing called the BRI, this background required information. And if you studied with us before, you know that usually we answer 5 questions every single time. What's the first question? Who wrote it? Yeah, and then what? To whom, and then when was it written? What's the literary style? What's the style of writing? And then the last question is, what's the reason written? Why didn't the author write it to these people? Like, what message or theme or important thing did he need to communicate to them? So we started and we jumped right into that fourth question of what's the literary style. We started talking about genre. We did not talk about who wrote it. We didn't talk about who he wrote it to. And we didn't talk about when it was written. And that was very intentional. If you read ahead in your book, you'll see that Job is a very unique book in the Bible. Sometimes when we're studying a book in the Bible, we say, we think this person wrote it. Church history's pretty sure. You know, it maybe doesn't say in the book, I wrote this with my own hand, Paul, right? Like some of the books do. Job is very unique. We do not know who wrote this book. We really don't. It's unknown. Who's the original audience? Who was supposed to hear it? Unknown. When was it written? Unknown. We really are in new territory when we get to this book of Job. We don't know a lot of things that we usually try to know before we study a book of the Bible. There's a few things that scholars talk about. If you do some reading in your study Bible, which I welcome you to do, they might say, you know, one thing we do know is that Job sounds a lot like Abram. His wealth is talked about in terms of animals and all the children. He lives a long time. Sort of sounds like the patriarch. So maybe Job lived back then, okay? But we still don't know who wrote it or who was the intended audience. Who was it that needed to hear this? Maybe it was written way back in that time of Abram. This could have been one of the earliest books written in the Old Testament. We don't know. Some scholars actually think there's something to be said for the fact that it could have been written while the Jewish people were in exile in Babylon. They were suffering in exile. They could have been asking the question, why did God do this? You know, like, why are we suffering in exile? And this book could have been written to that, but we don't know. The last question we're going to deal with right now, and it's on page 10 of your book, question number 8. And it says, what is the author's reason for writing? Well, if we don't know who this author is, if we don't know who he's writing to or when, then it's pretty hard to know what his reason for writing is. There is a Job scholar, his name is Christopher Ash, and when he teaches and writes about the book of Job, he says this, the author sets forth four propositions and one big question that the reader is meant to wrestle with as they study through the entire book. So even though we don't know why this book was written and to whom, he says, here's some important context. There's four important propositions that he wants us to think about the whole time we're reading this book. And there's one big question that he wants us to keep in the back of our mind. And that's going to be the context that we stand in. That's going to be sort of the dirt that our feet are in as we study, instead of the author and the time of writing and the original audience. So we're going to look at that together right now. So the first proposition, what does the author want the reader to know about Job? Most of you got the repetitions marked. When it comes to the character Job, what was said about him? What was said repeatedly about Job? Yeah, he's blameless and upright. The first proposition is that Job is righteous. The narrator says Job is blameless and upright. He fears God and turns away from evil. Yes. The narrator says it, God actually says it 2 times, right? He says it in chapter 1, God says it again in chapter 2. Throughout this whole book, Job's friends are going to dispute that fact. You know it is true because guess what? You had a little glimpse into something happening behind the scenes. So don't forget it. The other characters in this book are going to call it into question. They're going to dispute it. You know that Job is righteous. In fact, God's going to say it again in chapter 42, which is the last chapter of this book. God is going to say that Job is right. Okay? We know Job is righteous. Even after the disaster strikes, what does Job do? Yeah, he worships God. He blesses God. In all these things, Job did not sin with his lips. That's right. He worships God. He is righteous. The second proposition. So this is going to be proposition 2 and proposition number 3. What 2 things does the author want the reader to know about the Lord? Let's look at the first one. And we find this if we look closely at chapter 1, verses 6 and 7, and chapter 2, verse 1. What do you think the author wants us to know about the Lord? Yeah, he has authority. Actually, the proposition is that the Lord, and interestingly enough, if you read it in the printout of the ESV, is capital L, capital O, capital R, capital D, right? Which is the name Yahweh. So that is like the revealed name of God to the people of Israel. Okay, the Lord, Yahweh, is sovereign. The phrase that's used twice is that everyone comes before the Lord. Yes. So the sons of God come, which is this divine council of ruling heavenly beings like the angels. And also Satan comes. All these spiritual forces come, and they all come before the Lord. You looked at the setting, and what was the setting? What was the setting in this story? Where is it happening? Heaven? Where else? Yeah, earth. There's two settings, and actually it goes back and forth, right? It's this interchange between something is happening on earth and something happens in heaven, and then something happens on earth and then something happens in the heavenly realm. And what is happening in the heavenly realm is impacting what is happening on the earth. So proposition number two, the Lord is sovereign over heaven and earth. Okay? The Lord is sovereign over heaven and earth. We read this in Deuteronomy 10:14. To the Lord your God belong the heavens, even the highest heavens, the earth, and everything in it. Psalm 103:19 says, the Lord has established his throne in the heavens. That's what this sounds like, right? These people are coming into the throne room of God. He's sitting on the throne. The sons of God and Satan are coming before the Lord on the throne. The Lord has established his throne in the heavens, and his kingdom rules over all. And here's one throwback to last year, Colossians 1:15, right? You know what it says. He is the image of the invisible God, talking about Jesus, the firstborn over all creation. For everything was created by him in heaven and on, yes, on earth, whether thrones or dominions, rulers and authorities, all things were created through him and for him. He is before all things, and in him all things hold together. God, the Lord, is sovereign over heaven and earth. Okay, proposition number three. This is what we have to remember as we go through the book of Job. From chapter 1, verse 12, and chapter 2, verse 6. Is there anything unsettling in those two verses? Yes. Yes. That's the right answer. What's unsettling? That's right. God gives Satan permission to do things to Job. This is proposition number three. The Lord gives curious permissions. Curious permissions, because we're saying, why is he giving that permission? It's permissions that the Lord gives that we don't really understand. The Lord gives curious permissions. God says to Satan two times, behold, he is in your hand. It's okay for you to feel unsettled by this part. It is unsettling. Here's something to remember as you go through the book. You, the reader, you know that this has happened. Job has no idea. Job just went from, you know, this man of great wealth, exceedingly wealthy, very righteous and upright, blameless man with all these children and all the animals. And the next thing he knows, disaster strikes over and over and over again. Again, we see the interplay of these two realms. And first of all, there's human disaster comes. The Sabaeans come. And the text said they fall upon, the Sabaeans fell upon, and then disaster strikes Job. And the natural disaster comes. The fire of God falls from heaven and destroys Job's life, basically. Then human disaster again. The Chaldeans come and they are struck with the sword and they fall down. And then once again, natural disaster, this wind, a great wind comes and falls down upon Job. He moves from this outer loss of his possessions and his children to, at the end, inner suffering, physical pain, and a real emotional grief. Okay? What happens on the earth is governed and permitted by God in the heavens. That is curious.
Isaiah 45:7 says this, "I form light and create darkness." This is the Lord, capital L-O-R-D, speaking. "I make well-being and I create calamity. I am the Lord who does all these things." Whenever we talk about God's sovereignty, I think it is very important to remember that it is inseparable from the rest of his character, which is holiness and love. The sovereignty of God, we cannot wield that around like a club that we can hit people over the head with, okay? It is inseparable from his holiness and love. God is in control, but he is holy in how he wields that control. And he is fully loving to you in how he wields that control. Those things are true. Later in Job 5:8, in a couple chapters, Elihu is going to say, God does great and unsearchable things. We cannot understand him. Maybe even one of the things that we can't understand is, why does he point out Job in the first place? But while we can't understand or comprehend, we can know and we can trust that the Lord's character is bound up in goodness and love and justice. Why? Because we see it play out in Jesus. And he is the image of the invisible God. Look at Jesus and see the goodness and the love of a sovereign God who is in control of all things. And so I would just say and submit to you that when his actions don't line up with our vision of what is good, I think it is our vision, maybe that is out of line, or that we're not seeing all things. Maybe it's our definition of good in the first place that is out of line. Maybe we're thinking, this is what's good. This is what God should do. But it is never God that is out of line. That is our conviction. We are operating out of that conviction. We need to let you know that. Okay. What does the author want the reader to know about Satan? This is proposition number 4. This is that Satan has influence on the earth. We do have an enemy. We have an adversary, and he has influence on the earth. But we can add to that, it is limited by God. We are going to see that God has even Satan on a leash. He is in control of all the spiritual forces. 1 Peter 5:8 says, "Be sober-minded and be watchful. Your adversary, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion, seeking someone to devour." 2 Corinthians 4 calls Satan the god of this world. Ephesians 2 calls him the prince of the power of the air. In John 12, 14 and 16, Jesus calls him the ruler of this world. In Revelation 12, he's called the accuser of the brethren, the deceiver of the whole world. Satan, just another word for an adversary or the enemy, that is the word that is used in the original Hebrew here. This book, Job, is not concerned with Satan's access, okay? We're not here to debate, like, how often is he in God's throne room? Like, why has he been there? Like, God is holy. I thought God couldn't be around evil. The book is not talking about that at all. That's not a question that it's trying to answer. The book does want us to know that Satan has influence in the earthly realm. Okay, Satan, where was Satan when God said, "Where have you been?" What was he doing? Walking around on the earth, yeah, to and fro. Satan has influence. We're not told how much, but what we do know is that it is limited by a good, sovereign, loving, holy God. Okay? That's 4 propositions. What one big overarching question about Job does the prologue chapters 1 and 2 set up in the reader's mind? What was the question that Satan asked repeatedly about Job to God? Did anybody mark it? It's there in 1, 9-11 and 2, 4, and 5 if you want to look back to the text. Does Job fear God for no reason? This is the question that we are to wrestle with. This is Satan's accusation. And that is what? Job only fears God because what? He's wealthy. He's got a lot of stuff, right? God has blessed him. So of course Job fears God. The question is, will Job remain faithful if all of that goes away? Will he turn out to be a true believer? What's his motivation for his blamelessness, for his righteousness, for his fear of God? The enemy's question is actually for all of us who study this book of Job. Is God only worthy of love because of what he can give us or do for us? Is that what makes God worthy? Earthly blessings of possession and people and positions, those are all given to us by God, for sure. And there's the very real blessing of his protection and his help and his comfort in time of need. Those are real blessings given to us by God. But what happens if all of that goes away for us, for Job? I say this all the time. Do we love God for his hand? For what he can give us, what he can do for us? Or do we love God for his face, for his nature, his presence, his character, who he is? Do we find him worthy just because he is God? That is the question that we need to wrestle with throughout this whole book. And we're going to see how Job responds and learn from that. My conviction of this book is that it sets out a vision of God that is high and lifted up, that is a God that is unmatched in beauty and power and glory, and I hope you see that too. And it invites us into a faith that loves God for God himself, not for what he gives or how he protects or what he can do for us. And a faith in which all the other blessings that are blessings, they are given by God. These blessings of this life pale in comparison to the blessing of fearing God and living this life oriented towards him, which means in relationship with God, okay? Towards God. Some of you read the epilogue. You can read it after this when you go home. Everything's going to be okay for Job. The story's going to turn out all right. Those of you who did read it, what did you notice about God's restoration of Job? When you looked at the numbers in particular, what did you notice? Yeah. So what he has, God actually gives him back twofold, except for sons and daughters, which is this little interesting tidbit. And a lot of people think maybe it's pointing towards this idea of resurrection, that Job's children died, but he still had those children because there is life after death. So in God giving him the same amount of children, God actually doubled his children also. Okay, it's an interesting thing to think about. We don't know that definitively, but I was talking with Pastor Lee this week, and I said, I think that if you want to take anything from that, that's what you could take. And he said, that's what I would say too. So, but to be honest, you know, we could read what you just read tonight, those two pages, whatever that is, page 4 and 5. God gave curious permissions. He knew that his servant Job was blameless and righteous and upright and fear him. So he said, go ahead, Satan. Do your worst. Satan does his worst. Job loses everything. In his grief and in his loss, he does not sin. He passes the test. And so God just gives everything back to him. End of story. Except for the fact that that was chapters 1 and 2 and 42. So what in the actual world is left there in chapters 3 to 41. Well, that's what we're going to find out. That is what we're here to find out. And I do just want to end by saying, I would actually prefer the book this way. I would prefer to just skip very quickly from the suffering and the loss and the grief and just say like, yep, I praise you, God. It's okay. It's all good. I'm suffering, but you're still God. And then he can just restore me. Wouldn't you prefer life that way? Have you experienced it that way? Or is there 40 chapters of a messy middle that sometimes you have to sit in? Yeah, there is. Especially when it comes to things like grief and suffering and loss. I don't want to go through the messy middle. I want quickly, let's move to the restoration. The point of that epilogue is that the end comes at the end. But there is a long and messy middle that we have to get through in life sometimes. And you will find yourself crying out to God, sometimes yelling, sometimes engaging in debates with others and arguing for your cause. And it's a wrestle. It's not just easy, go from 210 to 4210. That's not how life works, okay? Wrestling takes time, and we are going to have to take time to wrestle through the messy middle of Job. So I want to say one thing about this, and then I'm going to dismiss you to pray. We are not going to dig deep into all 42 chapters of Book of Job, okay? We are going to fly over. We're going to get the whole story, and we're going to drop down and sort of camp ourselves in six unique places. Except for in the middle, we're going to cover about 20 chapters 1 week. If you say, oh, I love this, and you want to read through, read it. Read quickly. Don't read for depth. Just read quickly. But if things jump out at you, just like highlight them or circle them and keep reading. But in the middle, we're just going to point you to some specific places to read so you can get an idea of what's going on. Because how much repetition did you find in chapter 1 and 2? A lot? Well, that's not the end of repetition in Job. Like, it is just the same thing after the same thing after the same thing. And actually, the point of it is that you should get just really, really discouraged with how we're just saying the same things. And we're not coming to any conclusion. So if you are reading in Job and you feel very frustrated, you did it. You got it. You got the message. Okay? But when I dismiss you tonight, now we are going to actually read a small part. We're going to, for the next 2 weeks, we're going to read and study Job 2:11 to the end of chapter 3. And when we come back next time in 2 weeks, we are going to look at just that passage. Okay, and then we're going to sort of take off and skip over a bunch of things. Okay, that's how we're going to handle this messy middle. Okay, I just want to pray for you, and then I'm going to dismiss you to your group. God, we are thankful that you are sovereign, that you are before all things, and in you all things hold together. And we declare that even though we do not understand it, we do believe that you have evil on a leash, that you are God over good and you are God over evil, even you are above and over all things. All things are in your control. And as terrifying and unsettling as that can feel when we really take time to meditate on it, we also declare that you are good and you are holy and that your nature is bound up in steadfast love. The Lord, compassionate and gracious, slow to anger and rich in love. Would you reveal yourself to us through this book of Job, even in the times when we feel frustrated and confused and a little bit unsettled? Lord, grow our faith in those moments and help us to see you more clearly. In your name we pray. Amen. Hey friend, thanks for listening. For more information and to access our resources, visit crossridge.church/wstudy. And as always, thanks for studying along.